Order. This is the second meeting of the Minnesota Compensation Council, and I believe we have all returning members, so we don't need to do introductions again. I know we have a couple members who are excused for this meeting as well. So, first item on the agenda is approval of minutes from the last meeting. People had a chance to review it.
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chair, to approve the minutes of the last meeting.
We have a motion to approve.
Second.
We have a second. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you. We have four witnesses, I believe, here to testify today. And is Mr. Oxley here? He is. You may take the hot seat.
Well, it's a little mellower crowd than I'm used to, and I've got the whole legislature in front of me. So.
Well, thank you. I'm Dave Oxley, and I'm the executive director of ACEC Minnesota. We're a trade association representing about 150 engineering firms in the state. They do work for private and public entities, and I'm really here specifically to talk about how we pay our people on one level and how it relates to MnDOT in particular. We do a salary survey every year of our membership. We get a reasonable return on that with 150 member firms. I got 50 firms that responded this last year. 20 of those are essentially included in the numbers that I've given to you. It's a one-page document. I believe it's the fourth page in the handouts. And I know for our members, we struggle with, we don't mind hiring MnDOT people, but we'd sort of like to have MnDOT paying their people well enough that some really talented people would stick around for a while. They are a major client of ours, and we need good people on that side of the equation when we're dealing with projects. And a lot of folks, I think, bump up against the top end of the pay scale, and at some point they look for other opportunities, and the private consulting community is definitely one of them. And if you look at the salary information that I provided with you, again, it's very, very slim, but I think it's somewhat telling. This is for level five engineers. These are principals in medium to small firms or managers of teams, you might say. So they've kind of reached the pinnacle of their careers in these engineering firms. It doesn't include the largest firms, which I think would be somewhat different in the numbers, but these are, I think, the type of typical engineers that you would see in the upper levels of MnDOT as well. And what it shows is, for the average, the base salary, and that's just 2,040 hours a year, it doesn't include anything else, they're making about $120,000 a year. And if you go on the median, it's $116,600. As you can see, that is a reasonable fee. I should note that that doesn't include bonuses or profit sharing, which could add somewhat to the salaries of these individuals. So if I know my numbers at MnDOT, these numbers are above the highest level that you can pay anyone in MnDOT. So you can see how the private consulting community can be very enticing for moving people out. And we as a community, the engineering community, we want to see these numbers go up in MnDOT. We, again, find it very frustrating that really talented people are not able to stay because of the economic reality of the situation. So that's really all I have to say, as much as we would like to see somehow this cap be removed and create some opportunity for engineers in particular to move up. I realize I'm just talking about the engineering community, but I'm sure there are other entities within the state that have very similar problems as well as trying to keep people within the under the purview of state employment. So unless there's anything else, any questions for me?
I think we do have some questions. Mr. Hoffman.
Curious. Would you give me comparable numbers for the private industry?
Please explain. I guess I'm.
What you said. These are.
These are us. These are us.
Those are you.
These are the private sector.
Right here.
Right. And as I understand it, I believe MnDOT's top. Connie would know, he was there not too long ago. The top is about $108,000. And everybody's within about 2 or 3 cents of each other once you start bumping up in the top level. So. I always think it would be interesting to be a mid-level or upper-level engineer and say, how would you like to run a district? How much more are you going to make? Oh, about 2 cents more an hour. I'm not sure that it's a whole lot of incentive to take on that extra responsibility.
Okay, just one, clarification. So that 108 compares to the 140?
Correct.
Thank you.
Any other question? Representative Benz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Oxley, just for some comparisons later on, I know that when we're talking state employees, we're usually talking about, in terms of the benefits they receive, approximately another 31-32%. Can you give us an idea of what the benefit package would be like in terms of additional compensation on top of these?
I don't have really solid figures. It's be more anecdotal than anything. I would say, in general, the benefits are similar. I think that state employees probably enjoy a slightly better benefit as far as health insurance and some of the other programs that are provided to them. But I have a feeling that if you put, you know, again, I don't survey that, so I can't say with any certainty, but I think they're more close than you might imagine them to be.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you. Well, just so that you know, if you could think about your own package and the people that you work with, you probably would know. A state employee that pays, if they're individual, pays nothing for health insurance. Mm-hmm. And the cost of the state is somewhere around $550 a month. A family member pays about $132. An employee with family benefit, about $132, and that's about 10% of a $1,300 per month. But in terms of retirement, would that be a defined contribution, defined benefit? Could you give us some information?
Yeah, honestly, I don't. I've got another survey. If I dug into it, I could probably find it. 401ks, there are retirement programs that are available to the consulting community. I'm not sure they're quite as rich or as generous as the state employees programs are. I've often said in my next life I'm coming back as a state employee just so I can get the benefits. But the engineering community is relatively generous with their people. There is a big difference between the private consulting community and state employees in that I won't call it guaranteed employment, but if you're a state employee, you have a much better chance of having a longer career. In the consulting community, it does tend to go up and down with the economic economy, and though most people stay in this market, I know in the last 5 years, we've lost about 15% of the engineering community that was out there.
I guess my follow-up isn't a question now, it's a statement, Mr. Chairman, and that is, I think you probably answered it for me. I think there is some level of comfort in terms of employment, being a state employee. I think there is a much greater level of comfort in consistency of benefits, and I certainly know in terms of benefit regarding retirement. So, just a matter of, keeping that in mind as we move forward. Yeah, absolutely, when you're looking at what you're taking home every month or every 2 weeks, but there are additional benefits to state employees. And I'm not going to argue with you that I don't think that we need to do something with these, but I think we need to keep that at least in mind as we proceed.
I would agree. It's a factor that has to be considered. But still, I think the two are moving further apart as time has gone on, and I think it's reaching a point where I think the state's got to address it.
Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Question? Yeah, I was just curious. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Oxley, what level, this 140, what level employment is that? Is that like a mid-level person, or is that's not like a CEO of a company?
That wouldn't
or
be CEO.
An officer of a company. It's more of a high-level professional.
I would agree. Probably someone with 20 or 25 years experience that is running project teams. Could be a partner. I mean, there are different levels. A lot of these firms are employee-owned, so they may have a piece of the company and part of an ESOP, but they have a limited level of ownership within the firm.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions?
Mr.
Shore.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Oxley, thanks for coming in and thanks for this information. My question is a couple of different things. One is, do you have an awareness of the turnover rate at MnDOT, for example? That's your primary interest here. Let's say within the last 3 to 5 years. How many MnDOT engineers have left to come work for your clients?
That I actually wouldn't know. I suspect there's some people behind me.
Okay.
That have pretty good numbers for that.
And let me ask you this question. Maybe I'm not thinking about this exactly right, but help me understand why it's, if you're an employer and you're paying a reasonably good salary,
compared to MnDOT, and MnDOT employees are exceptionally qualified, why wouldn't you want those salaries to be low in order to attract them to your firms? Why would you want them to be equal?
Because we have to work with them. And I think one of the struggles I hear from my members is that they struggle with project managers that haven't been project managers for very long because the people that probably had reached that skill level have been absorbed into the engineering community or retired. I think that's really the bottom line is we want to be sure that there's some people that will stay, some really talented people that will stay within the agency. I know it's kind of counterproductive. You think as a private engineering community, we would just as soon draw everyone out. But we've got to work with this agency, and this agency is very important to us. This is, it's 5,000 people. It's got a huge budget. It's got an awful lot of projects, and they're very critical to all of us, and we want to make sure that the people we're working with are as top flight as we could have.
Thank you.
It appears there are no more questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Oxley.
Thank you for having me.
Next on the agenda is the Commissioner of MnDOT.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Good evening.
Committee. Good evening. I'm Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of MnDOT. Thank you for letting me appear. And I'm with Sue Mulhill, who is our Division Director of Administration for the agency. And I'm just going to introduce a few introductory kind of ideas, and then Sue will fill in a lot more details. We'll both answer questions, and I'll jump in with my opinions here every so often. I'll just kind of be brief. We do have a PowerPoint, I'm not sure it's really loaded in here, and I think it's been handed out to you in all of your packets. So maybe in the interest of time, you can just follow along with your packet. Because we do have a brief presentation, I think, some interesting kind of arithmetic. I guess the overall point, and I'm being fairly new to the agency. This is my fifth week. But one thing I have been struck by is the competence and the quality of some of the experience of the people who are there, particularly in kind of division leadership, district engineer roles. What frightens me is that a number of them are very vulnerable to leaving the agency. And my understanding is, in kind of getting to know it, that a number of people have left over the past few years. I think that the experience and their competency is really critical in advancing the agency and running the agency. And it's certainly my interest that we be as competent and as professional an organization as we possibly could be. I know that for the vision of the agency is for supporting a world-class state, and I think it would be very difficult to do if we have more turnover. I think you'll see from Sue's presentation that we're reaching a really critical time organizationally for the agency. The only other thing I'd like to add, because I did come from the private sector as of 5 weeks ago, and in my past business as a CEO, we had a number of years where we did regular increases. We had many years when we had zero increases. But in every year, we benchmarked our management and most of the organization to the market. So, in fact, with the compensation philosophy of trying to be somewhere within the mean in the private sector, we had times with no kind of general increases, but there were adjustments because if for critical roles within the organization, in order to retain and then at times attract people to positions, we had to make sure we were within the market. And that's obviously a private sector practice, but I've heard at times people say, well, the private sector has been under, economic difficulties. We don't do increases. I know a lot of businesses and peers who are CEOs of organizations, some public, some private, and every one of them are very cognizant of where the market is for key management positions and are And when even though those companies are saying we are not doing increases, absolutely, in fact, they are ensuring that those key positions are within a range of the marketplace. And Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, I think you make a good point about benefits. I think, again, drawing on my private sector experience, we do look at total compensation. And I think total compensation, there are ways to provide comparables because that's kind of a standard practice. You can quantify what the benefits, the values they are. My fear is at MnDOT, even with that kind of total compensation point of view, and very kind of richer in benefits than private sector, there still is a compression here among key positions, which will cause the, I think, again, the next few years, it could be a very difficult situation. So filling in more details, I think we'll get
Okay. So I'm Sue Mulvihill. I'm the division director in charge of employee and corporate services. I'm also an engineer for the Department of Transportation. I've been there a little over 29 years, so I've lived through a bunch of different positions there. The first slide here is just some statistics about our department. If you're not very familiar with MnDOT, we have about 4,700 employees. We have 8 districts across the state, so we're geographically distributed, and we have a lot of technical and maintenance field kind of employees that are managed by supervisors and managers. We have the professional series in MGEC and in MAPE. And the group that we're kind of talking about mostly here is the managers group in the managerial plan. That 3% number there is are the folks that are experiencing the compression that you're probably hearing about. And that's about 150 people in our department of 4,700-some folks. So I'm going to go to the next slide, and I'm just going to touch briefly on a few things on each of these, I think. The difficulty attracting and retaining talent. These are just a few examples of some of the positions within the last 4 years that we've had difficulty with. Our chief financial officer position, we had 4 different individuals in there in the last 4 years. The first person left to go work for a county within Minnesota for additional money. The second individual was an internal person who we put in a work out of class in that chief financial officer job. He also left and went to work for a city down in the southern United States, and he's making substantially more money also. There was a third person who was an external candidate. He came in for a couple of weeks, and he actually got another job offer from a private company in northern Minnesota and left after just 2 weeks. And thankfully, during that time, we were growing a person internally who was a business manager who had some financial skills from another agency in the state. And she has filled that position, and she does have a little room in her salary to move up. However, if she leaves that position, I think we're going to have difficulty finding a qualified applicant that will come in and fill it and stay with us for a significant amount of time. And our finances are pretty intricate, I would say, and very detailed. And so a person needs to understand federal financing, state financing, all kinds of different things to successfully be our CFO. So it would take a while to build somebody into a successful person. Our district engineers, we have 8 district engineers across the state. Many of them were near retirement age in the last 5 years, and so we've had 6 of them retire in the past 4 years, and 5 of those positions we posted internally and with cities and counties, and that is typically our practice with district engineer positions. In addition, these are kind of the crown jewel of positions out in our greater Minnesota districts. They're in charge of their area. They work with legislators. Some of you probably know some of our district engineers. And of those 5 positions, when we posted those, even though that was open to all counties and city engineers based on their qualifications, we had 13 applicants for those 5 positions, and only 3 of those were external folks that were looking at coming to MnDOT for a district engineer job in greater Minnesota. So that's a concern for us. I'm going to leave state aid till the end. The office directors and high-level managers, those positions there, deputy commissioner and commissioner, there are 7 folks within those groups that have left MnDOT, and the reason that they left was 4 positions for greater money in other areas of the state. Some went to counties, some went to consultants, and they left for more money. And those are highly skilled positions, and they have a lot of strategic management responsibilities. The state aid managers specifically, I want to talk about them just for a second. We have a state aid division director who has reached the rule of 90. A lot of you will know what the rule of 90 is. When you reach 90 years, your age plus your years of service added together, you're eligible to retire for a substantial amount of state retirement. Many folks leave MnDOT at that point and go work somewhere else, a city, a county, a consultant, because they've reached kind of their retirement age, and they're not going to go anywhere up in the salary or the per hour cost of in MnDOT, so they choose to leave. Our state aid division director is eligible to retire right now through the rule of 90, and her direct report that runs our state aid office that deals with all the counties and cities across the state, he's eligible in April of this year. And our concern about that is attracting a county engineer potentially to come in and take on those positions. They need to know the county system, they need to know county funding and projects, and so with the ability of counties to pay up to as much as $160,000 a year, we're concerned about the quality of folks that we may get to apply for them. Not to mention the fact that a lot of the lower paid counties are outstate Minnesota, and when you come into the metro area, you're spending a lot more of your income on cost of living here in the Twin Cities as opposed to outstate. So we're concerned about those. Do you want to say anything about the rule of 90 now?
I was talking earlier with Sue, and I have a story about the rule of 90. In my previous job at Jefferson Bus Lines, we were able to actually recruit a new safety director who, of course, comes from the Highway Patrol, but still on his anniversary date, Rule of 90 came into effect. We were able to attract a pretty competent safety director who was able to leave his job and get whatever it was, 70% of his salary continued, plus the full-time pay working for Jefferson. It was actually, you know, this is a case where actually, you know, I was thrilled that we were able to actually find a person that competent. But frankly, it's not fair to the state agency.
So the next slide is this handout that you have, a large one, so you can actually read it. I have bifocals. I don't know about you guys, but I can't read small stuff on this little thing here. So the top darker pink area is represents folks currently capped by the governor's salary. It includes managerial levels, district engineers, division directors, some of the people I just talked about, office directors. Their salary could go up as high as $126,000 right now by the contracts or the plans that we're under, but we are capped at the $108,388 because of the governor's salary. The next pink box under that is the next level of managers down from them. And right now there are 64 folks in that lighter pink box. Those people, this under 6% means that within 2 or 3 years, they could potentially be bumping up into the dark pink category. So we could have 104 people within the cap, totally capped, not got any room at the top of their salary to move up at all. And that could happen in the next 2 to 3 years. And then the yellow box below that's our MGEC folks, some of the folks that Dave was talking about, and some Middle Management Association people at the higher professional levels. They have approximately 4 to 5 years before they start bumping up into the two pink boxes above them. So the compression problem that we face is that when folks get a 2% salary increase, that raises the top of their range, and they start bumping up against the people above them. The other thing about the yellow and the blue at the bottom is that those are all groups that have bargaining impacts, and so some of what they would be talking about at bargaining is the amount of their salary that they get and the fact that they're bumped up against the folks above them. And then I'm going to move on to this organizational chart, which I think is my last piece, and then Commissioner will close out.
Representative Holman has a question.
Oh, sure. Thank you. If I might, on this chart, you said they're totally capped, but some of them are still under plans. Do you have any breakout of these 40 employees, what plans they're under?
Actually, most of those would be management plan.
Most of the 40?
In fact, I think all of them
I'm
are
sorry,
the management
Mr. Chair.
Plan.
Yeah. All of them, you think, mm-hmm. are management plan?
And I'll be able to illustrate that a little bit with the org chart that you'll see next, because all those folks are on that org chart in the red boxes.
If I might... can you tell me for how long? I'm assuming under the management plan, because they're capped, you said they could go as high as 126 if there wasn't?
If there was no cap.
Wasn't the cap, and so...
Within the ranges right now.
If I might,
you may.
Mr. Chair, when you say within the ranges right now, so would they all be above the capped amount? Or how do they fall in that range from 108 to 126?
Representative Holberg, the only way that they could do that is if we allowed them to go above the cap. They can't go above the 108, 388 right now. But what I mean when I say ranges is when there's, in the management plan, or the book, there's a range of salary available for somebody who's at a 25M or a 24M. And it goes from X number of dollars up to $126,000. So if the cap was lifted, potentially folks in these management plan levels, office directors, district engineers, division directors, could be placed at higher than $108,388 within the existing plan that exists between the state and the agencies.
So if I might just, for clarification purposes, so their ability to hit the cap or exceeded is not a function of some type of labor settlement, but rather a book or a guide that equates experience and education, et cetera, to various pay ranges. Is that correct?
I believe that's true. It's the bargained plan, the managerial plan, that gets bargained by MMB and the unions.
Mr. Chair, the managerial plan is a compensation plan for unrepresented employees and is determined by the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. It's not really negotiated. It's just established by that commissioner.
And then there's a range. The range within there is the amount of salary that you could pay someone, but we're capped by the governor's salary cap.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Benz.
I can hold questions until she's finished, but I have...
Well, if it's on topic
it,
now...
It is, yeah. On that very question, thank you, Mr. Chair, in regards to how they make it, is that based on a performance? Is there a merit evaluation, an annual merit evaluation that would allow for the rater to compensate that person as long as they're within the range and underneath the cap, a certain level of... Or is it a mandated percentage?
There are performance appraisals done annually on employees. The way that it doesn't necessarily set the amount of compensation that you get, but if you are not performing at a level that's acceptable, then we start a disciplinary process, which essentially gets you out of the Department of Transportation if you're not performing your job. But the performance appraisals do not help set salaries. It is based on what your last permanent job assignment was, and then typically in the state give a 10% salary increase for someone who goes into the next level up.
Clarification, follow-up?
Okay,
I'm trying to understand. So I've been promoted. I'm within the range.
Mm-hmm.
Federal speak, that's level. So I'm in within the level, and I'm within the range, and every year I get a merit evaluation, maybe a couple, to help me with my performance improvement plan if I need it. I don't want to get disciplined. But somewhere along the line, doesn't that merit factor into what kind of potential raise they're going to get for the next year?
Okay, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask my staffing person back here, Jim, to help me out a little bit with this.
I'd like to just speak in here. For the record, I'm Jim Lee from Management and Budget. The plan that she's referring to, the managerial plan, does not have steps in it like the union contracts do. So when the performance appraisals are done, the agency head usually has some flexibility to spend a merit pool, if you will. Yeah. Some X percent a year can be spent on individual pieces. Right. And how that's distributed is largely up to the agency.
Thank you. I've got a couple of follow-up additional. One of the things that I would be concerned about if I were in your shoes, given you know your the number of people who seem to be leaving the agency because of what you deem as salary issues or whatever, does the agency have a succession plan?
Mm-hmm. We do, and many of the folks that are on this organizational chart here are folks that we look at to succeed into high level positions within the department. I can illustrate that a little bit better if we talk about this chart about succession and what happens when we look at this.
Mr. Chairman, yes. If I might just assist in terms of what I'm used to in terms of a succession plan, but if I'm a district manager, I'm tasked with finding at least three people who could take my place if I were to leave the agency for any reason. That's what I'm used to, so please describe if you could.
Well, we're about two or three deep in different positions. So the folks that are assistant district engineers or assistant office directors normally are gaining the skills of the office director or the division director that is in charge in the line above them. We have done various kinds of succession planning in the department with all the levels of management. There was a time probably about 8 or 9 years ago when we did some serious succession planning. I was involved in that. I was probably three or four levels below where I'm at today. And I think one of the difficulties that we're having is the folks that went through that succession planning process, a lot of them have retired or gone on to other positions. So we're still building the folks that are in the succession plan within our agency to succeed people who retire.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I don't want to get too far afield, and I can ask these questions offline in terms of that. But I got one last. I'd like to get your impression of a couple of things. You know, you've worked in government long enough, you find workarounds. And I don't know if this fits within what we've legislated and what you're tasked to do. But one, pay for performance, and then whether or not there is an opportunity with the way the legislation is written that some of these compensations issues could be circumvented, so to speak, if they were paid after retirement. So you take your last check, but you've accumulated $100,000 in the course of, you know, I've got a cap, but I can be paid up to $126,000. So while I'm being employed, I got the cap, but some money goes into 2%, 3% as I'm working up to $126,000, so that when I retire, you know, if I retire, I guess, before January, that's a good thing, but I don't get paid for that additional in the next year. Is that even possible? No.
You know, I'm going to look at MFP.
Interesting idea.
I wouldn't presume to say that.
Mr. Lee, I don't know if you heard the question. I think your expertise is required here.
I think what the member is referring to is what is typically
deferred
called deferred compensation.
Right.
Oh, deferred.
And you find them in some positions, maybe the president of a university or something, where a certain amount of money is dedicated to a fund that will be paid out after the person leaves their position. That is impossible with state employees. The way the cap is structured, there's a limit on what you earn in any particular year or at any particular time. So on any given day of the year, you have to be at an hourly rate that's below your commission. And there isn't any way to cut money away to get it out of that.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. You may continue.
Thankfully, the MMB man is here. All right, the last slide that I'll talk about is the organizational chart that you have, and I gave you a larger one of those also. And so the boxes in red represent the 40 or so folks that I talked about at the top of the previous chart that are currently being paid. They're at the salary cap. there's a couple of examples on this chart. You can see the larger row in the middle that starts with Nick Thompson on the left and ends with Michael Barnes on the right. Those are the division directors, and I'm in the second box there from the left. There are one of them is eligible to retire right now under the rule of 90. Two of us are eligible to go within the next 5 years. Mike Barnes, I believe, is eligible within seven. And then we have a couple of young guys who are probably in their 40s or early 40s at least. I don't even know if they are 40. And they are hot commodities in other parts of the state in private industry. I know for a fact that one of our folks, John Chigle, has been offered jobs out in the private industry already. So he and Nick Thompson are young and up-and-comers, and for a penny an hour to move up to a deputy commissioner, probably isn't going to look too attractive to them if they can get something additional on the outside. So that's one point about that group. I will point your eyes over to the Policy, Safety, and Strategic Initiatives Division on the left-hand side. Three boxes down, there's the Traffic, Safety, and Technology box. Our deputy commissioner now, Bernie Arsenault, had that job in 2008. In 2008, our former commissioner, Tom Sorrell, brought Bernie over to the central office and had him become the Policy, Safety, and Strategic Initiatives Division leader. So he was over a division as opposed to just an office that was a functional group of our department. And then in 2010, Bernie acceded up to the deputy commissioner position within MnDOT. And actually, before Commissioner Zelli came on, Bernie was our acting commissioner. In all those moves through the department, Bernie increased his hourly rate by 13 cents an hour. And so it's just an example of how small the incentive is to move from a single functional group within the department that has to do with traffic safety into a all-encompassing deputy commissioner job within the department. So it's just an example of some of the things that we have going on within our organization. The green boxes, folks, they have room to move within their current salary. And there's one blue box on there. He's our CIO, Chief Information Officer. He's actually above the cap. He's above the commissioner in our department. About 53.
How's that work out?
Yeah, I don't know. He wanted to appoint himself to that job when he heard it. So I think that's just a little bit of information about how compression at the top of our department is affecting our agency and some of the folks that work with us and with the commissioner.
Well, just as a concluding remark, I think we all recognize that compensation may not be the only reason people are working at MnDOT. In fact, it is obviously not. We kind of would expect that that this experience, culture, and loyalty is clearly a big driving factor. But just philosophically, to be able to be closer to the market, we know really does play an important role in retention and in attraction, bringing up, actually kind of even recruiting from within. I think this most compelling story for me was just the search we did for a division director. I'm sorry, for a district engineer in the Rochester area, and the fact that we had very few from the outside applying, and we have a great candidate internally, but what scares me again is really over the next few years is to kind of look at this picture, and it's all in that organizational chart, to see whatever plan we have can't really be fulfilled if we don't have the talent that takes a while to learn. To be able to kind of grow within the agency. So that's our story. We're happy to take questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions?
Ms. Ronnie.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Baldhill, thank you for your testimony. You indicated that you were concerned about turnover among the top eight, your third slide down here. Mm-hmm. You indicated you were concerned about turnover. How would you characterize the trend of turnover? Are you seeing faster turnover in the recent years as opposed to years on back? Can you quantify that for us?
Ms. Ryan, I don't have exact numbers, but from my experience working at MnDOT, we are seeing faster turnover of folks leaving to go out to the private sector. And I think when they reach the rule of 90, going out to take on a different function or a different job. I've seen more of that in the past. It used to be folks stayed 30, 40 years, and it's less than that amount of time now.
Thank you. I have one more question.
You may follow up.
Commissioner Zelli, you indicated that you were able to hire a man who retired from MnDOT or our highway patrol.
Public safety.
Public safety. And he was able to maintain his 75% or 70% of the salary plus get another salary working for you full time. Now, was that salary higher than what he was making at his agency, Highway Patrol?
That's a good question. I don't know the specific answer. I believe it was at least equal to or higher. And quite frankly, for the business, I think it was clearly an opportunity to have a talented person, which was considered, and I think still is considered, a bargain.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Scully.
Ms. Mobile Hill, is the rule of 90 no longer in existence? I mean, has it been sunset or,
Mr. Scully, I think people that got hired after 1989, my folks can correct me back there if I'm wrong, are not eligible for the rule of 90. So it is not a factor any longer.
So when you talk about people leaving for the rule of 90, it just happens to be some of those people who have been long-time employees.
Mm-hmm. Folks in my boat, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In your boat, okay.
And I think the point is not that we should change rule of 90, but in order to recruit and bring others along, we need the tools of more market-based compensation to fill those positions, because we're going to probably have more turnover because of those kind of old practices.
One other question. When people leave, do you do exit interviews with them?
Yes.
And is financial the top reason why they're leaving?
In some cases, financial is the top reason. In other cases, it's not. But at the top levels like this, it certainly is a factor.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Hoffman.
I guess the rule of 90, of course, that's gone by the board. And I think your turnover numbers would be lower if you didn't factor in the retirees that are leaving after the rule of 90. But like you say, we're working our way through that, mm-hmm. and that won't be an issue anymore. But I would assume that a lot of your turnover is for that. I mean, that's what I hear, and I hear that in a number of places. I'd like to ask Mr. Zelli now, coming from the private sector, how would you change it? What do you recommend? Because I would guess as you compare private to public, with the benefits, with the with the pensions, the defined benefit, rule of 90, which you have, what would you change? That flat salary schedule, or what would you do?
I think what is required is to raise the ceiling, because that's probably the most immediate issue, because that'll come closer to what I would expect to be closer to a market rate. But I think that doing a market survey to kind of know where particular positions are competitive to the field would be helpful. I think some rule of saying when you're outside 10, 15, 20% off of what a market benchmark from a third party could determine might be reasons for exceptions in order to retain or recruit for a particular position. I could think of a number of different solutions, and I'm just really here to kind of tell you the problem, but I think there are probably a lot of wonderful creative solutions that you could consider that wouldn't necessarily be a budget buster across the board, but would allow for a key position to be able to be competitive to run complicated organizations.
And you hit the nail on the head. In other words, not across the board. So is that your...
I think across... I think a ceiling is across the board.
Okay, but that's lifting that, and then the... Okay. Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure if the two of our testifiers can, but I'm certain that Mr. Lee might be able to. But if I'm not mistaken, doesn't the governor have a capacity to raise the 108 to 114 right now on his own?
He does.
He does. Okay, so we could see, if the governor wanted to, Mr. Chair, we could see that we could have an immediate 5-6% increase in wages if it was just for an action of the governor. And then and this follow up last question regarding this. If we were to raise the governor's salary, to, say, $150,000. Now, that's his cap. He could decide not to take it. Would that change the 95 and, you know, the Group 1, 2, 3 rule? Just because he chooses not to take it, he could, in fact, relax, if I'm not mistaken, he could relax where the rest of the salary ranges go. Am I mistaken with that?
Mr. Chair, members, let me clarify my first rather succinct answer.
Why don't you come forward a little bit, and maybe the microphone will have a chance of getting it.
The governor doesn't have unilateral authority to change the salaries of the agency heads from 108 to the 114,000 statutory limit. You would need to make that request of the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. And you would need to vote on this increase. If the governor's salary were raised to 150,000 in statute, Mr. Shepard, maybe Mr. Hubinger, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the statutory salary, and then 95% up yet is the cap. So, yes, the agency head limits will go up whether or not the governor takes the whole salary.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Back to the answer to the first question. I was on that employee relations subcommittee, and the governor did not make a request to increase those. So I guess my question still goes back to, it would require our action, but he needs to initiate that?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Schroeder.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, thank you. Just recalling that Auditor Dayton, I recall, had a salary of a dollar a year at one time towards the end of his term. Representative Benson, I recall that. I had two questions, I guess, and a follow-up. Two questions, Commissioner and Ms. Mulvihill. Do you have a recommendation for the council? I also would point out that you weren't at our last meeting, but we have two additional scheduled meetings of the council in order to meet our timeline to get the recommendations to the legislature to incorporate into their schedule as well. So it would be great to do lots of analyses and further study on many different things, but we may not have the benefit of doing so, which points out my question as to ask you if you have a recommendation. And then secondly, assuming that you do, and it would require additional funds, where would the money come from?
Well, Mr. Schroeder, I think that MMB, we're here to support what Minnesota Management and Budget is bringing to you. I have an opinion what I think would be a way to do this, but I don't think it's probably appropriate for me to share that. I think you would need to make sure that the money is available for both for out of the general fund or the Trunk Highway Fund to be able to fund any increases like that. And I don't know how much money it would be, so we'd need to actually take a look at where it would come from. Within MnDOT, it's the Trunk Highway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a follow-up on the question that Mr. Hoffman asked of Commissioner Zelli. I believe his question was specifically the salary, the ticket price.
Right.
What about how do the benefits compare, specifically the health insurance benefits, from your perspective coming from the private sector coming into the public sector or the government sector? Because I think that's a factor that this committee needs to consider, and it's not necessarily in that sticker price of the base salary.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. What I mentioned up front was taking a look at total compensation is completely legitimate, and certainly in the private sector, when benchmarking compensation, you look at total compensation, meaning the value of health, any savings, whether it be 401k or defined benefit, vacations, you name it, to really get an apples-to-apples comparison. I think using these base salaries, this compression that we're kind of describing here at MnDOT, is really illustrative of a ceiling. So we're giving you kind of trends and directions. Clearly, public sector benefits are higher than private sector, so we're not coming, the previous testifier had some specific numbers, but it is our sense that having a way to come closer to a market within a median, within a range on a median is kind of a reasonable goal. certainly looking at total compensation, I think, makes total sense. But to say that a higher health care package would outweigh a 40% disparity in compensation really isn't coming that close. I mean, but it's certainly a reasonable consideration.
And I, Mr. Chair, I apologize. My House colleagues have informed me that that question may have already been asked, so I apologize to the committee. But I was in the Transportation and Public Safety Committee that went long, so I'm sure Commissioner Zelli appreciates that.
Not a problem. Any other questions of the witnesses?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been trying to stay quiet because I'm a member of a council here. I'm trying to look at all levels of government, but this subject is really close to my heart, and I do want to make a few comments if I can. I think it's all about ultimately, and I think the current governor said, the previous governor said it, that we need to have good government. And the chart that Ms. Mulvihill showed, the one with the pink, white, yellow, that's headed to disaster. In about 4 or 5 years, yeah, I know it's not popular to give government people a raise, give managers a raise, make government bigger and all of that. I get all that. I'm now on the private side making really good money. really good money compared to where I was. As a matter of fact, at MnDOT, I was in those red boxes for 9.5 years. I never got a raise. I was advanced 3-4 levels up to deputy commissioner and made the same amount. I always talked about $20 a year equated. The kids always ask me, Dad, you got a new job? Yes. How much is that? Oh, about $20 and 80 cents a year. When they were little, you know, they were asking, well, what does that mean? I said, that's probably two Costco chickens you're going to have per year more every night for dinner. So that's all that was. But I think it's a really serious matter. It may, the world won't end if these folks don't get a raise. But I think it's really critical, especially in the professional technical areas. I could care less what the governor makes. With all due respect, Mr. Commissioner.
You're not worrying about me, Carl.
Yeah, I'm not worried about Commissioner Zelli, because whoever is in those chairs, to be frank, they will benefit later from being in a commissioner position, and they will make all kinds of dollars later. But I'm worried about the professionals, that are there do the work. And if you truly want to have a competitive agency in a state, I think our government agency, if we all agree that government agency and MnDOT will be here and other agencies will be here to be part of the solution, and I think they need to be organized well and at least be competitive. Right now, when you're talking about these district engineers, when I was Metro District Engineer in 2007, as a matter of fact, when the bridge collapsed, we have assistant county engineers, and I had 1,500 people working for me, and I had a budget of $1 billion, and we had small assistant county engineer who was in charge of maintenance was making more money. And that's a fact with every position. So every at the level of a commissioner, a deputy commissioner, a district engineer, cities, counties, federal government, they all make around. The previous commissioner, Sorrell, took a $40,000 cut in pay to come work for Governor Pawlenty. He was making $40,000 more. The same with consultants. You heard the story. So you have state government here that gets stuck with politics, and that's fine. I totally get it, and it's an easy target. But I hope if, in general, we cannot – the ideal solution to me may be to separate all these professionals and maybe the commissioners out from under the governor's salary. If people don't want to give the governor a raise, to pull them out from under there, and then maybe – I'm not saying that every government agency should get paid more. I know this one should in certain areas, all the professional areas. So I'm not sure. I don't know, Mr. Chair, what the recommendation ultimately will be, but I hope it's genuine and we try to do something that'll keep I don't think they expect too much. Hell, $20,000 will keep people around. I mean, cost of living. is all you're talking about. You know, they're not talking to double their salaries, and all these people they see the ceiling coming, and why should not all of them are sick like me to go to take these promotions and don't get compensated, take all the headaches, whether it's politics or dealing with people, and everybody's ticked off about your decisions, being at a high level. It's not an easy job. I'm sure Commissioner will find out, and not get compensated for it. So why would they? So what do? They come work for me, for Susan. They pay real well, and that is fine. But Mr. Schroeder, you mentioned why should the ACEC why should they support this? Why should they have the government people get paid more? And I think exactly what he was saying. I don't think us consultants want to eventually deal with, especially with the MnDOT. I'm sure it's true with other agencies that I don't know about. But with MnDOT, you want to deal with technical people. You want to deal with competent engineers. There was never more attention to engineers and how important they are during the bridge collapse. Now, all of a sudden, people are starting to loosen up again. So you want to deal with your counterparts. You don't want to deal, consultants don't want to deal with bean counters, with account, no disrespect to accountants, to auditors, to managers who don't know anything about the technical world. I don't think that's healthy. And so with that, hopefully we can, first of all, thanks for MnDOT folks for coming. And Mr. Chair, that's all I had.
Thank you. Mr. Scully?
Commissioner, Ms. Mulvihill, you're asking, you want the salaries to be competitive, and aside from who's going to pay or how it's going to be paid for, what would be a competitive range? What would you like these salaries to be bumped up to? I mean, maybe that, you know, you're not here prepared to say that, but what would make it competitive? Mr. Oxley showed what, you know, the private sector, the consultants are, but what would make MnDOT competitive in these positions that you've showed us? I mean, how much of an increase or what type of a salary range?
Well, Mr. Scully, my thought on that would be to look at what Mr. Oxley brought forth and what MMB's provided you about local public works agencies and county engineers and city engineers, things like that, city planners, other kinds of HR managers. I look through MMB's package information, kind of come up with an average salary out of that would be competitive with them in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just will support what Sue said. I think getting even public sector, not necessarily only private sector, benchmarks in the responsibility, just to know what that range is really the starting point. I just don't know specifically what it is, but I'm sure that's pretty easy to figure out. In terms of, and I agree, in terms of commissioners, maybe in deputy commissioners, to get a CEO of a $2.5 billion company, you're not going to pay that. And you don't have, really you don't have to. But I think this idea is really the professional core of this agency. It needs to be closer to what the marketplace says. And that's benchmark is pretty easy to find. I don't have that. We haven't done a compensation survey, but we could. And MNB could.
We want to be a little careful, too, not just to represent transportation. We're here on behalf of the other state agencies, too, so we would want to work with MMB to figure out what that would be.
All right. Any further questions? Appears not. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Next. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Council. My name is Barb Sporline, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner at Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Thank you for the opportunity today. I'm here on behalf of Commissioner Mary Tingerthal, but she's in D.C. testifying at a congressional briefing on rural housing issues. But we thank you for the opportunity. This is a very, very important topic for our employees, for our agency and the state, and we really appreciate the time that you're taking to work on this with you. I'm just going to give you a very brief overview of our agency. We're a little bit different type of state agency, and not a lot of people are familiar with us. I'll describe the materials that were distributed to you, and I'm going to speak specifically to the impact on the salary cap, and if you want to go other places with that, then I'm prepared to do that as well. You got three pieces of information in your packet. One is an agency overview, just a two-sided agency overview, and in the interest of time, I won't go through that in detail, but we were created by the legislature in 1971 in response to the findings of a serious shortage of affordable quality of housing for low-income Minnesotans. And they found that the private building and investment sector was limited in their ability to provide this housing without assistance. There was a real lack of sufficient long-term mortgage finance for such housing. So that's why we were created. We finance our lending activities through the sale of debt, so thereby we create obligations to our bondholders. So the statute did provide for us to have an independent governance structure that's very different. The overview, and I'll get to that in a minute, our strategic priorities are listed on the front page of that overview. They include supporting successful homeownership, preserving affordable rental housing, addressing specific critical needs, preventing and ending homelessness, and preventing foreclosures and supporting community recovery. We invested $638 million last year in housing, served many, many households, and as you can see by the numbers, very low-income households. On the back, you can see a little bit about our funding structure. About 56% is from the sale of bonds. Federal funds, about 25%. State appropriations, 9%. And our own agency resources, 10%. We have total assets of about $3.26 billion. What differs us from other state agencies is that our statute provides that the management and control of our agency is vested solely in the members of our board of directors. And they did that independence governance structure to demonstrate to bondholders and the rating agencies that the control of the board is vested in a board whose primary responsibility is to protect the bondholder interests. So we are a financial institution, and we are evaluated by investors and rating agencies. Our affirmed GO rating right now is AA-plus from Standard & Poor and AA-1 from Moody's. And it's that high credit rating that allows our agency to have ready access to the capital markets and to fund programs at lower interest rates. And this is what the rating agencies cite us as credit strength: strong overall financial capacity, strong overall asset quality, that's our loans and our investment securities, ongoing state support for the agency's mission, an extremely capable and proactive management, and continuity of operations and staff. Our agency budget is not funded by state appropriations. It's our own agency resources. And nearly all of our assistance is provided through a network of private delivery partners. We do not own or operate housing. So while our assets and our scope and our impact, our investments and our impact is large, we actually are a fairly small agency. We have 220 people. In addition to the agency overview, you should have received a relatively small Excel spreadsheet that's a state housing official salary data. In going through the materials that you received on your meeting, the last meeting on the 18th, you had two attachments that had select salary positions from different state and local agencies. There were no housing positions in those two attachments. So we found comparable data from 2011 from the National Council of State Housing Finance Agencies. That's our professional association. And we put it in the format, the exact format that you have in attachment 4. So hopefully that will be helpful for you when you do that comparison. And then final handout is our salary structure of our senior leadership team. And as you can see, and this, I think, goes to Representative Holberg's question about movement if the cap is eliminated. This is our top, this is our senior leadership team, the 10 positions, and 7 members are currently at the salary cap, 7 members of that team. And the impact of that, and this has already been spoken to by others that were testifying, but it really is compensation not commensurate with the level of responsibilities and accountability. And I think no one expects senior management to be compensated at the same level as the private sector. But when compared to public sector counterparts, there is definitely a pecking order. And I spent the last 23 years working for the city of Minneapolis and the city of St. Paul, and 18 of those in management. And I can tell you part of our marketing was that we pay better than the state. And I hate to admit that now, but it's true. Lack of any future increases, compression for other salaries, especially other managerial plan salaries, and, of course, limited increases for employees who, in our succession planning efforts, we hope would be promoted, but they would get a very limited increase because we still have to try to protect some differentiation. If the cap is eliminated, all of the people currently capped would have some room left in their range that's in the managerial plan, and you can see that in that attachment. It's not a ton of room, but it's a start, and it's some room. They also would have the opportunity for possible future range increases if that was approved as part of the managerial plan increases. I think of particular concern to the commissioner and to me as somebody, part of my responsibilities in the agency are talent management and employee engagement. I'm also responsible for strategic planning, business planning, and you know we are working hard on these issues. And 38% of our managerial plan employees are eligible to retire in the next 5 years. And as you can see in the chart, it's 7 of our 10 senior leadership team members. Turnover has not been an issue at the senior. It's going to be an issue at the senior level. We have fairly healthy turnover at the lower and middle levels, but that's all very manageable. Their compensation structures are more in line. That's pretty typical in public sector. So for us, the senior-level positions in financial institutions are critical for sustaining our high credit ratings and bondholders' confidence, and the ability to recruit highly qualified people for these positions is limited not only by salary ranges at the senior level that are not aligned with our public sector counterparts and definitely not the private sector, but it's very discouraging to it's made worse and very discouraging for potential and existing employees to learn they have no chance for any salary increase. In recognition of our salary concerns and anticipating so many upcoming key retirements, we did undertake a compensation study, and we have good data. And it shows that our mid-level and senior-level professionals lag well behind our labor market average rate for qualified employees in comparable positions in our industry. And we certainly can make that information available to the council if you want it. It's about 15% lag for the mid-level and between 29 and 44% for senior-level. Again, that's expected at the more senior levels, but the disparities between the levels of government locally are particularly key for us. We have, relying on recent private sector retirees with a public service mission is not a very sustainable staffing model. It restricts the applicant pool, and it doesn't promote the continuity of staffing that's critical to rating agencies. I'll give you a current example. Our CFO, our bond counsel, our finance director are agreed to come work for us post-retirement, and they've given us a fantastic few years of service. They're ready to really retire now, and we're lucky that their experience with us has been good, and they're helping us to try to recruit. Met with one today, and he asked about the salary, and his face changed significantly when I told him what the cap was and that there'd be no chance of an increase. So I think that elimination of the salary cap will not resolve all of our compensation challenges when trying to recruit and retain to highly qualified and motivated employees to work in state government, but it will help, and it's a great start. So I can stand for questions.
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Commissioner, thank you for coming in and sharing the information with us. Is it I have a couple questions for you. Mm-hmm. You're a bank. You have a board. Mm-hmm. You spend a lot of money, but you don't spend nearly as much money as other enterprises in state government. The commissioner before you has a budget that's substantially larger than yours. Do you have a recommendation for the council on the specifics of your agency? And second question related to that is, if you do, has your board weighed in to pass a resolution of some kind in support of that?
Mr. Schroeder and members of the council, our number one recommendation is elimination of the salary cap. It does help. It gives us some room within the current ranges. We undertook the compensation study with the full support and knowledge of our board, so we do have a salary structure that we could look at, but we are working collaboratively with MMB on putting forth a legislative agenda, and we're asked to focus on the salary cap issue for now, but we are certainly prepared to talk about alternative salary structures if that's where the conversation goes. And yeah, our board is very supportive of that.
Mr. Chair, so just to follow up, Commissioner, so has there been a resolution by your board specifically on your recommendation? And secondly, is Governor Dayton in support of your recommendation to remove the salary caps for your agency?
I believe that the administration – no, we don't have a board resolution. We certainly could get one, but weren't heading in that direction for today's testimony. The administration is supportive of the elimination of the salary cap for all agencies, so we are not specifically seeking remedy for our agency. We are here on behalf of all the agencies who have similar compression issues due to the salary cap.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Hoff?
Question. You mentioned that you have a low turnover rate and you have about 38% of your managerial employees eligible to retire in 5 years. Would you say the fact that you haven't had a high turnover rate is based on the fact that you have above average benefits and definitely above average pension plan?
Well, I would say that there's a lot of most of the people that work at the agency are fully dedicated to the mission of the agency. So there is a love for the work we do and how tangible the benefits are, the impact that we're having. We do have a higher turnover rate at the lower and mid-level. We just haven't at the managerial plan level yet because they were progressing until they hit the cap, and they've been at the cap for, and at this point in time, with 30 years invested. We did have our consultant who we commissioned to do the compensation study, did a high-level analysis of the employee benefit program, and I think Commissioner Zelli spoke a little bit to this. While the health insurance program is certainly, you know, more generous than in the private sector in terms of the employee contribution and the deductibles and co-pays, when you look, again, I'm looking at senior level, when you look at and some people say, well, that's an offset for direct compensation. But executives and senior management, the relative value and percentage of that is reduced. And they have so many other compensation forms that are just not available to us. So it's apples and oranges. So we do benefit from better health insurance and co-pays and that sort of thing, but not the other benefits. And there isn't just an apples-to-apples comparison at the senior management level. So, you know, if you look at that as a value of your total compensation, if your total compensation is less, then it's going to be less. If it's 30% of your compensation, but your compensation is 29 to 44% less, then that value is going to be less. But and just a personal story for me, I've only worked in the public sector. I love public administration. Public service is important to me. I have been lucky that I have a spouse who makes a lot more money in the private sector, and when I took an $18,000 pay cut to take this job, I could do it because it's the position I wanted in the agency that I wanted to work for. But not everybody can make that choice.
Ms. Mahal.
Yeah, so we've heard a lot about this issue of folks retire, there not being an issue with retention on the upper end, but yet a huge issue around recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm speculating as to why that is, but my sense, and this might be a question for MMB, it seems to me why that might be the case is that because folks at the near retirement age had some benefits that no longer exist, so wouldn't be a part of recruitment today. For example, Rule of 90 and other retirement benefits that were seen at the time as being pretty pretty meaningful that don't exist now. I'm trying to reconcile that issue of there not being a retention problem, but there is a recruitment problem.
I can also speak to some recent recruitment efforts and the conversations we're having, too, Dr. Jim.
I was just going to say that I think that you hit on the one difference, and that is the rule of 90 not being available to newer hires. And otherwise, the benefit package really isn't that geared towards tenure.
And then if I might kind of follow up, because I do think, you know, the root of some of these questions I think are really, really important, which is that issue of retention and recruitment and the benefits being extremely different today than they were 15, 20 years ago. And I think that's important. And then I think it's really going to be important for us to get quite specific about the other benefit differences in terms of we know that healthcare in general is more meaningful than probably the private sector, but I would be interested in really exploring whether or not retirement is and other benefits.
If I could, Mr. Chair, just a couple of examples of recruitment discussions for senior level positions. I looked through the managerial plan and I saw the ranges. Why can't you offer me the top of the range? Oh, well, we have a salary cap, so you can't get to the range. Well, when will that be lifted? After 6 months, a year? Well, at this point, it's not. So you can't get any increases ever during your tenure here in this position. Well, okay, then how about vacation? What if we go 10 to 12 weeks of vacation? Well, of course, it's limited. The vacation is limited to a schedule that MMB knows more about. What about stock options or bonuses, incentive pay, pay for performance? Not an option. Okay, part-time. It's a full-time job. You know, I mean, we just don't have what they're used to negotiating on. So we really talk about public service a lot and the mission of the organization and the work environment and that we have a supportive administration and we're hopeful that we, you know, can at least eliminate the cap issue and get a little wiggle room at the top. So,
thank you.
We're still recruiting.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the Deputy Commissioner, I believe, has the highest possible. You see the 124. Is that because that individual is particularly qualified, or are deputy commissioners across the spectrum in a deputy commissioner range, no matter what their skill set is?
Representative, I honestly don't know that. I don't know if Jim knows that. I just I don't know why, out of all the housing finance agency executives, that's our sort of official title, and then they have the what the real position is in parentheses. Other than the CIO, which has a much higher salary structure, I don't know why the deputy is higher than the commissioner or the bond counsel. I don't know why that's in the managerial plan that way. It was well before my time with the state. So,
Mr. Lee.
Chair, members, the deputy commissioner salary ranges are contained in that managerial plan that is updated every 2 years and goes through the process of approval by the Subcommittee on Employee Relations and eventually the full legislature. So yet, like all the other managerial classifications, they've had occasional updates of the pay ranges while the agency head ranges have stayed static for 15 years. So that's why the deputies now theoretically could make more than the agency head, except for the cap.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
You may.
Thank you. Just for clarification, so the deputy commissioner that could theoretically get 124,466 would have to be somebody with a lot of state experience, a very high level of education. They would have to meet other criteria just other than being anointed the deputy commissioner. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yes.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Comment, I guess, and a question in terms of, first of all, I think the compensation plan is still a defined benefit, so we might have removed the rule of 90. It's not the same as a 401 and a defined contribution. It's defined benefit, I should say, plan. Is that not correct?
For most managers, classified managers, it would be a defined benefit plan, but at the agency and deputy level, right, it would be a defined contribution plan.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, so for most of the positions that we talked about tonight, we're talking about, even though the Rule of 90 for newer employees might be gone, they still get a pretty generous defined benefit plan. It's not a defined contribution 401. I think like maybe we believe it is. My concern is that we continue to talk about eliminating the cap, but in essence, to really make a difference, we're going to have to rewrite legislation so that it doesn't any longer require executive level or governor approval or his referring it to the subcommittee on employee relations and then full approval by the legislature, because in essence, we're not even at the top of what could be paid now in most of these mm-hmm. cases. So what we really are saying is that we don't want it to be tied to a political process, but unfortunately it is. It has mm-hmm. been. I mean, we have agencies heads that have not seen raises in 15 years, but we're not even at the top. So there's a lot more moving parts to this than just saying we want to eliminate the cap. I mean, this is going to take legislative approval to change in the entire process to say we're going to go to market-based, and when we go to market-based, we're talking about total compensation, to be clear, you know, salary and benefits. You can't exclude those when you're marketing for these kinds of positions. But we're going to have to say that once we find out where those are, market-based, and where we want to be in the market, 50 percentile, 75 percent, or whatever, that the process of allowing executive or agency heads to make decisions of where people are going to be in that whole thing has to change. Now, I think our compensation program is broken, quite frankly, and I think we are missing a lot of opportunities. But just so that everybody's aware, it's not just simply saying we're going to eliminate the cap that will do this. It's far more. I mean, it would be great if this session we could just say, We think the governor should make a recommendation that everybody should get a raise to their level, because I think there's a lot of study and work that needs to be done to say where are we headed in the next 50 years in terms of compensation packages in the state, and does what we do now make sense regardless of the cap? I guess that wasn't a question, that was a statement.
Well done.
Okay. Any other questions, comments?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to echo about the about it being broken. I look at this chart you have here, CIO making more, which is, God bless them, they're very important elements of our business. But that was, it becomes divisive within organizations, maybe not yours, but in general. CIO, when I was deputy commissioner, you had to sign and approve, allow the 3-4 people in more organizations, the computer guys, to make $120,000 to approve that. And this is all because, as you know, and I mentioned it last time, because of year 2000, Y2K, the world was going to end in the year 2000. So frantically, in 1997, 98, 99, we worked on giving these folks a raise to keep them. Given market, you know, there was a market analysis done. They can make as much as so many percent of the market with the private side, actually. And so we kept them so the world wouldn't end with state government. And we did that, and everything was fine now. But to me, this is obsolete at this point. You know, why should they make more? I mean, I don't want to offend anybody. Again, good for them that they're making more, but I don't think it's fair to other professionals. That's all.
Any other questions, comments for this witness?
Thank you. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Any other witnesses tonight? Let me make a suggestion that it didn't occur to me in the last meeting. Maybe we ought to take a 5-minute break before we go into the discussion. We've been going for an hour and a half. All right, we'll adjourn or recess for 5 minutes.